Washington Bridge. Washington had ordered its evacuation, but then acceded to Greene's bizarre decision to defend it at all costs, which contradicted the prudent advice Greene had been urging earlier. It fell on November 16, 1776, all of its nearly 3,000 defenders killed or captured. With Howe preoccupied at Fort Washington, the remnant of Washington's army escaped across the Hudson at Peekskill and assumed full flight across New Jersey. There was not much of an army left. When Hancock wrote him to inquire about his military intentions, Washington responded politely. "Give me leave to say, sir, that our affairs are in a more unpromising way than you seem to apprehend. Your army is upon the eve of its political dissolution." The heady era of Raj Militaire, the belief that patriotic conviction would trump British military superiority, was dead forever. More New York and New Jersey colonists were now signing up with the British than the American army. Washington himself, whose fervor for the cause had made him temporarily vulnerable to the belief that virtuous amateurs could defeat mercenary veterans, now abandoned his own hopes for a quick end to the conflict. A short war meant a British victory, which was in fact imminent. The only hope was a long war, fought by the kind of seasoned troops who would have stood their ground in New York. The old Continental Army was now effectively defunct. Unless a new army could be raised with all possible expedition, Washington warned, I think the game is pretty near up. One of the quaint customs of 18th-century warfare was the belief that armies should not fight during the winter. Having botched his chance to trap Washington's decimated force on Manhattan, Howe now proceeded to miss another opportunity, it would turn out to be his last, to hunt down the crippled residue of the Continental Army as it limped across New Jersey in November 1776. He chose instead to place his troops in winter quarters around Trenton, while he himself returned to New York and the arms of his mistress. Washington, on the other hand, who by all rights should have welcomed the opportunity to hibernate and lick his wounds, was still thinking offensively. "As nothing but necessity obliged me to retire before the enemy," he wrote to Hancock, "I conceive it my duty, and it corresponds with my inclination, to make head against them so long as there shall be the least probability of doing it with propriety." Apart from his own inclinations, which probably referred to his personal urge to redeem his somewhat tattered reputation after the New York debacle, Washington recognized that the entire movement for American independence was on the verge of extinction, and might very well expire on its own over the winter. He needed to strike some stroke. The result took the form of a surprise attack on Christmas night across the ice-choked Delaware River, subsequently immortalized in Emanuel Leutze's famous painting. Recent scholarship has corrected certain long-standing misconceptions about this pivotal battle, which is generally regarded as Washington's most tactically brilliant operation of the war, and the moment when the Continental Army went on the offensive for the first time. First, art historians have argued that Washington could not possibly have been standing in the prow of the boat, as the Leutze painting claims, for he would have been hurled headlong into the ice. But the boats used for the crossing were not as Leutze described. They were high-walled barges akin to the landing craft used for amphibious assaults in World War II, and everyone stood up in them. The Leutze painting is at least symbolically correct in the sense that Washington personally led the assault across the river in a driving sleet storm and was in the vanguard of the attack on the garrison of Hessian mercenaries at Trenton. Second, the legend that the Hessian soldiers were drunk, sleeping off their Christmas cheer, is a myth. The Hessians were exhausted because they had been on round-the-clock alert for over a week, expecting an attack. When Washington's 2,400 troops descended upon them, they fought bravely, but were outgunned by the 18 artillery pieces Henry Knox had somehow managed to transport across the river. They suffered about 100 casualties, and 900 were captured. American casualties were minimal, though among the handful of wounded was a future president, Lieutenant James Monroe. Third, Washington's plan for the attack on Trenton, like most of his tactical schemes, was excessively intricate, calling for a carefully timed four-pronged assault. Three of the four American units never made it across the river. Confronting Washington with the decision to proceed with questionable resources or abandon the attack, he chose to run the risk, figuring that the American cause was so desperate that boldness ran fewer risks than caution. It was an all-or-nothing wager, and he won it. A week later, he did it again at Princeton. Embarrassed at the unexpected defeat at Trenton, the British sent General Charles Cornwallis with a superior force to attack Washington's army encamped at Trenton. But Washington learned of the planned attack and quietly slipped away in the night, marching his 6,000 troops toward Princeton, where Cornwallis's rear guard was stationed. Again, the British were surprised. This time in a more conventional battle with several artillery exchanges and bayonet charges. Sighting, January 3, 1777. The Pennsylvania militia have just broken in the face of heavy musket fire and grapeshot. Suddenly, Washington appears among them, urging them to rally and form a line behind him. A detachment of New England Continentals joins the line, which first holds and then begins to move forward, with Washington front and center astride his white English charger. The British troops are placed behind a fence at the crest of a hill. Within 50 yards, bullets begin to whistle, and men in the front of the American line begin to drop. At 30 yards, Washington orders a halt, and both sides exchange volleys simultaneously. An aide, Colonel Edward Fitzgerald, covers his face with his hat, certain that his commander, so conspicuous a target, was cut down. But while men on both sides of him have fallen, Washington remains atop his horse untouched. He turns toward Fitzgerald, takes his hand, and says, "Away, my dear Colonel, and bring up the troops. The day is ours." And it was. The Trenton-Princeton combination did not inflict serious military damage on the British, but it did force Howe to rethink his troop deployments in New Jersey. And, most importantly, it had a massive psychological effect on American public opinion. What had appeared to be a lost cause now enjoyed a new lease on life. The two actions also served as defiant gestures by Washington himself that fight was still in him. Having made that point, though his aggressive instincts would remain a dangerous liability, he never again felt it necessary to risk his entire army in one battle. It was as if he had successfully answered the challenge to duel, and now could afford to adopt a more defensive strategy without worrying about his personal honor and reputation. He also began to realize that the way to win the war was not to lose it. The Fabian Choice. Even before he entered his winter quarters at Morristown, Washington apprised Hancock that his only non-negotiable request, verging on a demand, was for a permanent standing army, which he would have total power to shape into the kind of hard and sharp instrument necessary to persevere in a long war. It may be said that this is an application for powers that are too dangerous to be entrusted, he acknowledged. I can only add that desperate diseases require desperate remedies, and with truth declare that I have no lust for power, but wish with as much fervency as any man upon this wide-extended continent for an opportunity of turning the sword into a plowshare. The Continental Congress granted his request for a temporary delegation of dictatorial power. The situation truly was desperate, and they had no alternative. But its own limited power over the states to fill the manpower quotas meant that Hancock's strong expressions of support, plus the bounties offered for volunteers who served 3-year enlistments, remained hopeful wishes that never quite came true. It is certainly astonishing, and will hardly be credited hereafter, wrote one of Washington's in-laws, that the most deserving, the most favorite general of the 13 United American States should be left by them, with only about 2,500 men, to support the most important cause that mankind ever engaged in against the whole power of British tyranny. Actually, as enlistments expired in January 1777, Washington's army probably numbered about 3,000, though he felt obliged to conceal the real number, lest the British realize that a winter campaign would surely end the war almost by default. Washington spent much of the winter waiting to see if enough new recruits would show up to form an army capable of a spring campaign. He made two important decisions at Morristown. First, he recognized that the smallpox problem required a more comprehensive solution. If the hospitals are in no better condition, he told Hancock, our regiments will be reduced to companies by the end of the campaign, and those poor wretches who escape with life will either be scattered up and down the country and not to be found, or, if found, totally enervated and unfit for further duty. Given his manpower difficulty, he could ill afford to see a quarter of his troops incapacitated, as had occurred in New York. Or else, he warned, we must look for reinforcements to some other places than our own states, presumably referring to the Kingdom of Heaven. In March 1777, he made inoculation mandatory, and set up special hospitals in Philadelphia to implement the new policy. Second, less out of conviction than a realistic recognition of his limited resources, Washington came to accept the fact that he must adopt a more defensive strategy and fight a war of posts. Also called a Fabian strategy, after the Roman general Fabius Cunctator, who defeated the Carthaginians by withdrawing whenever his army's fate was at risk, it was a shift in thinking that did not come naturally to Washington. A Fabian strategy, like guerrilla and terrorist strategies of the 20th century, was the preferred approach of the weak. Washington did not believe that he was weak, and he thought of the Continental Army as a projection of himself. He regarded battle as a summons to display one's strength and courage. Avoiding battle was akin to dishonorable behavior, like refusing to move forward in the face of musket and cannon fire. Nevertheless, he was now forced to face what he called the melancholy truths. New York had demonstrated that the Continental Army could not compete on equal terms with British regulars on the conventional battlefield. And given the reduced size of his current force, it is impossible, at least very unlikely, that any effectual opposition can be given to the British Army with the troops we have. The most bitter and melancholy truth of all was that popular support for the war, the essential engine for producing new recruits, continued to sputter despite the Trenton and Princeton victories. One French partisan of the cause claimed that there is 100 times more enthusiasm for the revolution in any Paris café than in all the colonies together. In effect, he had no choice but to become an American Fabius, or else simply surrender. In late March 1777, he dispatched Nathaniel Greene to brief the Continental Congress on his revised strategy. "I explained to the House Your Excellency's ideas of the next campaign," Greene reported. "It appeared to be new to them." The Congress was apparently taken aback, because a Fabian strategy meant that Washington did not intend to defend Philadelphia at all costs if Howe chose to make it his target. His highest priority was not to occupy or protect ground, but rather to harass Howe while preserving his army. Adams, writing from Philadelphia, assured Abigail that he was safe. "We are under no more apprehensions here than if the British army was in the Crimea. Our Fabius will be slow, but sure." Richard Henry Lee, another delegate in the Congress, informed Washington not to worry about defending Philadelphia. "Your army, sir, feeble as it is, and the North River are more tempting objects." What Lee called the North River was another name for the Hudson. Lee's assessment, in retrospect, was strategically correct. Howe should either have attempted to destroy Washington's army, or he should have occupied the Hudson Corridor, probably by joining up with General John Burgoyne's army coming down from Lake Champlain. Each of these goals had decisive strategic implications. Instead, Howe decided to capture Philadelphia, which had symbolic but no strategic value, and he chose to launch his campaign in the most roundabout manner imaginable. Rather than march overland across New Jersey, he loaded his army onto ships at Staten Island, sailed out into the Atlantic, and eventually circled back toward Philadelphia through the Chesapeake Bay. Befuddled by Howe's summer cruise, Adams joked that he might as well imagine them gone round Cape Horn into the South Seas to land at California. If nothing else, Howe's odd tactics thoroughly confused Washington, who needed to keep his troops ready to move quickly either toward the Hudson or toward Philadelphia, contingent on where the winds carried Howe. By August 1777, once it was clear that Howe's army was coming up from the south toward Philadelphia, Washington entered his Fabian phase. The orders issued from headquarters continued to reflect the old patriotic rhetoric and the old Washington preference for decisive and aggressive action. "Now is the time for our most strenuous exertions. One bold stroke will free the land from rapine devastations and burnings, and female innocence from brutal lust and violence. The eyes of all America and of Europe are turned upon us, as on those on whom the event of the war is to be determined." His personal correspondence also exhibited his reflexive urge to throw caution to the winds and engage Howe without fear and without constraints. "I shall take every measure in my power to defend Philadelphia," he wrote to one worried city official, "and hope you will agree with me that the only effectual method will be to oppose General Howe with our whole united force." but in all the councils of war, his generals, especially Greene and Knox, kept reminding him, and one senses that they had to keep reminding him, that preserving the Continental Army was a higher priority than protecting Philadelphia. The lion had to become the fox. The first battle occurred at Brandywine Creek on September 11, 1777. Washington was outmaneuvered by Howe's quite simple flanking tactic, which split the American defenders and created a complete rout. Howe subsequently claimed that the entire Continental Army could have been destroyed but for the cover of darkness at the end. But that extravagant assessment failed to recognize that Washington had left himself an escape route once the battle went badly. It also failed to recognize the upside of the American troops' failure to stand and fight, namely, they ran away very well. British casualties totaled about 600, American nearly double that number. In the aftermath of what was clearly another British victory, Washington attributed the defeat to bad luck and claimed, in an 18th-century version of spin control, that American casualties were fewer than the enemy's, a falsehood that he probably justified as a public service to the wavering cause. Brandywine reinforced two unattractive facts. First, that the superior discipline of British regulars made them masters of the battlefield unless vastly outnumbered. And second, that Washington's inexperience at managing his force on a large battlefield beyond his visual control virtually guaranteed that he would be outgeneraled by Howe. The second battle occurred at Germantown on October 4th. A textbook illustration of the phrase, the fog of war, Germantown was a near victory for Washington that was transformed into a defeat when, at a crucial moment in the battle, American troops fired on each other amidst dense fog and smoke, thereby permitting the British to regroup. Washington's original attack plan was an excessively intricate four-pronged scheme that proved impossible to coordinate, especially during the night march toward the British lines. The attack was intended to be a complete surprise, but Howe was alerted to Washington's plan at the last moment by Loyalists. Sighting, October 4, 1777. With the battle in the balance, Washington has ridden forward with his staff to the sound of heavy musket fire. The American advance has stalled at a stone house, a sturdy 2.5-story dwelling owned by Benjamin Chu, now occupied by over 100 British troops pouring a murderous fire from the windows. Washington asks his staff whether this formidable fortress should be bypassed or attacked. Henry Knox insists on the latter course. We must not leave a castle in the rear, and Washington defers to his judgment. Knox then directs four light cannons to fire on the house, but the cannonballs bounce off the stone walls. The heavy fog thickens, limiting visibility to a few yards and causing confused American troops to fire on one another. An officer volunteers to go forward under a white flag to propose terms of surrender to the defenders, but they shoot him down in the foggy confusion. Washington supervises several assaults on the house, all futile. The Chu house is never taken. The American advance is stalled, perhaps fatally. After action, reports agree on 2 points. The fortress should have been bypassed, and 75 American bodies lay bayoneted in the doorways and windowsills, while the interior walls, splattered with blood, resembled a slaughterhouse. At the end of the battle, the British still held the field, and American casualties, about 1,000, doubled those on the British side. Nevertheless, Washington insisted that the battle could easily have gone the other way. The troops had fought valiantly, exposing the British army as not that invincible body of men which many supposed them to be. In his correspondence afterward, he again distorted the casualty lists to exaggerate the American achievement and, in effect, claimed victory. He even adopted the posture of the victorious commander toward Howe, making a point of returning Howe's dog, which had been found wandering the battlefield searching for his master. A grimmer version of Germantown, as an example of strategic victory, came from Thomas McKean, a prominent Pennsylvania lawyer and ardent patriot. "If Your Excellency attacks and disables 1,000 of the enemy a week, and are constantly reinforced equal to the numbers you lose, as I trust you will, you must soon prove triumphantly victorious and get the game, though you should not throw sixes," presumably meaning risk and lose your entire army in the process. As Washington was learning to play his new role as a somewhat aggressive fox, the pivotal battle of the war, actually a series of battles, was being waged north of Albany. Throughout the summer of 1777, Washington received regular reports about the steady progress of General John Burgoyne's army as it moved down from Canada, presumably for a rendezvous with Howe somewhere along the Hudson Corridor. Howe's inexplicable decision to sail south toward the Chesapeake takes on truly bizarre status in the larger strategic context, since it left Burgoyne's force of 8,000 troops marooned in a sea of hostile militia from western New England, which rallied by the thousands to reinforce the contingent of Continentals commanded by Horatio Gates. Washington sent Benedict Arnold, his most daring and battle-tested general, along with Daniel Morgan's brigade of sharpshooters, his elite infantry unit, to assist Gates. But the Battle of Saratoga became a textbook example of the decisive role that swarming militia could play when teamed effectively with regulars. It was also one of the few occasions in the war when militia functioned according to the Minuteman ideal, prompting Washington to observe that he could have obliterated Howe's army outside Philadelphia if New Jersey and Pennsylvania militia had rallied with equivalent zeal. The outcome was devastating to British presumptions of inevitable victory. On October 17th, Burgoyne surrendered the surviving remnant of his battered army, nearly 6,000 men. Saratoga radiated shock waves as far as London and Paris, causing the British ministry to consider getting out of the war and the French government to consider getting in. Tremors were also felt within the Continental Congress, where the stupendous success at Saratoga cast Gates's star in ascendance and invited behind-the-scenes comparisons with Washington's failure to prevent Howe's capture of America's capital city. The discrepancy was not lost on Washington, who found it difficult to acknowledge that he had played only a minor role in America's greatest victory of the war. His congratulatory letter to Gates ended on a sour note. "I cannot but regret," he wrote Gates, "that a matter of such magnitude and so interesting to our general operations should have reached me by report only," meaning that Gates should have sent a letter under his own signature. Gates was also informed that Washington was sending one of his most trusted aides, Alexander Hamilton, to Albany in order to detach the bulk of Gates's force and bring it down to Pennsylvania to join the main army under his direct command. Saratoga, in short, was a splendid victory, but it must not encourage anyone, including Gates himself, to forget who was the commander-in-chief. The truth was that Saratoga unleashed a whispering campaign against Washington that had been simmering beneath the surface ever since the debacle at Fort Washington. The larger truth was that criticism of Washington could only take the form of whispers, since his transcendent status as His Excellency levitated above all political squabbles, making direct criticism almost sacrilegious. Nevertheless, there were audible murmurings in the corridors of the Continental Congress, asking how such a supposedly brilliant general could lose so many battles, the last one permitting capture of America's capital city. Benjamin Rush, who had once championed Washington's distinctive status as quasi-king, now wondered out loud whether such power was compatible with Republican principles. Most of the criticism was more muted. John Adams offered the shrewdest assessment. "Now we can allow a certain citizen to be wise, virtuous, and good, without thinking him a deity or a savior." Within the army, anti-Washington sentiment was especially virulent among the small but politically influential group of French officers who had been promised high rank by members of the Congress anxious to encourage a Franco-American alliance. As a general rule, these French claimants were unqualified in all areas except their own exaggerated sense of superiority. And it was invariably Washington who was forced to inform them that neither the promises made nor their inflated military credentials would suffice to qualify them as generals. One of the most arrogant and irritating of the group, Philippe du Condrey, ended his protests dramatically by spurring his horse onto a ferry on the Schuylkill River, then drowning when the horse, which could swim much better than du Condrey, kept going out the other end of the ferry. But the most troublesome protester was Thomas Conway, an Irishman by birth who had risen to the rank of colonel in the French army. Washington had described Conway's proposed promotion to general as unfortunate a measure as ever was adopted, and Conway himself, as a man whose importance in the army exists more in his imagination than in reality. Conway did not take kindly to such assessments. What came to be called the Conway Cabal was more a gossip network involving a handful of disgruntled players within the Congress and the Army that questioned Washington's judgment than it was a full-fledged conspiracy to have him replaced, presumably with Gates. Once Washington let it be known that his own network of informants kept him fully apprised of the loose talk behind the scenes, both Conway and Gates fell all over themselves, disclaiming any malevolent intentions and insisting on their total loyalty to him and to the cause. If Conway's gossip campaign had the possibility to grow into a more serious challenge to Washington's authority, or to the assumption that His Excellency and the cause were synonymous, this quickly evaporated with Washington's deft exposure of the not-so-secret conversations. For their part, Conway and Gates had learned that questioning Washington's judgment, and implicitly his unique authority, was akin to purchasing a one-way ticket to the sidelines, which, in the end, is where both of them landed. But the episode did generate more revealing reverberations within Washington's own mind. Because the Fabian role had never rested comfortably alongside his own more aggressive instincts, the accusation that he should have been able to prevent the capture of Philadelphia reinforced his own sense of failure at Brandywine and Germantown. The whisperings in the corridors, in other words, echoed the whispering in his own head, and his honor-driven belief that the refusal to engage Howe's army in one all-or-nothing battle was somehow a betrayal of his personal reputation. He kept asking his staff to formulate plans for one more engagement, presumably victorious, that would then permit him to take his depleted and frazzled army, a third of whom did not have shoes, into winter quarters. The strategic decision to make the survival of the Continental Army the highest priority, the realization that he must fight a protracted defensive war, remained at odds with his own more decisive temperament. Green tried to remind him that he really had no choice. "Your Excellency has the choice of but two things," Green advised, "to fight the enemy without the least prospect of success, or remain inactive and be the subject of censure of an ignorant and impatient populace." Knox chimed in with the same opinion. "But I believe there is not a single maxim in war that will justify a number of undisciplined troops attacking an equal number of disciplined troops strongly posed in redoubts and having a strong city in their rear, such as Philadelphia." The clear lesson of Brandywine and Germantown, Green argued, was that the Continental Army was no match for Howe's regulars. Let the gossip-mongers in the Congress, all blissfully ignorant of this unattractive truth, persist in their naive chatter and their veiled preference for another Gates-like victory. Washington's greatest responsibility was to ignore such critics. He must also ignore those voices in his head that regarded the presence of Howe's army in Philadelphia as a standing challenge to his reputation. "I wish that it was in our power to give that army some capital wound. The reputation of the army and the happiness of our country loudly calls for it. But in consulting our wishes rather than our reason, we may be hurried by an impatience to attempt something splendid into inextricable difficulties." Washington's highest duty was not to answer his critics or satisfy his sense of personal honor, but rather to win the war. He knew that Green was right, but he could not resist the memory of the Trenton-Princeton successes of the previous winter, and kept searching for the opportunity to repeat that moment of glory in order to end the current campaign on a triumphant note. Once again, Green warned him against entangling his personal agenda with the strategic imperatives, or his public responsibilities as commander-in-chief. "The successes of last winter," Green observed, "were brilliant, and attended with the most happy consequences in changing the complexion of the times. But they were really only psychological victories. And if the bills of mortality were to be consulted, I fancy we were no great gainers by those operations." He concluded with another lecture. "Let us consider the consequences that will result from a disappointment in a measure of this nature. In the first place, it will be attended with a vast expense and the loss of many lives to no valuable purpose. It will prove a great obstruction to the recruiting service, and a defeat will give a general alarm and spread universal discontent throughout the continent. It will expose the weakness of the militia to the enemy, and not only them, but to all Europe, who now consider them much more formidable than they really are." It took every ounce of Washington's legendary self-control to hear and accept Green's counsel, which ran against his grain, as well as his wounded pride at being the butt of unofficial criticism. But eventually, he embraced Green's realistic appraisal as his own. This is one of several moments in Washington's career when his decision not to act merits special recognition. Since another major engagement with Howe outside Philadelphia risked the existence of the Continental Army. It also marks the moment when Washington, who had been struggling with the unpalatable idea for over a year, finally and fully accepted his Fabian role, emotionally as well as rationally, along with the recognition that it would be a protracted war in which the preservation of the Continental Army was the priority. These decisions, in turn, completed his transformation into a public figure whose personal convictions must be suppressed and rendered subordinate to his higher calling as an agent of history, which in this case meant that winning the war was more important than being himself. On December 17th, the general orders announced the end of the campaign, and the decision to move the army into winter quarters near a previously obscure location in Pennsylvania called Valley Forge. The orders declared that he himself, meaning Washington, will share in the hardship and partake in every inconvenience. This, it turned out, was not really true. It was true, however, that the man and the cause were now completely synonymous, not just in the public mind, but in Washington's as well. Chapter 4. Destiny's Child. Looking back from the privileged perspective of the present, American victory in the War of Independence became inevitable after William Howe missed his chance to destroy Washington's army in 1776, and then the disastrous British defeat at Saratoga the following year prompted France to enter the conflict on the American side. Space and time, so the story goes, then became the inexorable allies of independence, both swallowing up and wearing down British military pretensions. The decision by the British ministry to adopt a southern strategy in 1778 and 79 proved a futile effort, which bogged down in the Carolina swamps after a series of tactical British victories that, thanks to the inspired leadership of Nathaniel Greene, added up to strategic defeat in a savage war of attrition. Eventually, Lord Cornwallis found his battered army marooned in the Yorktown Peninsula, where Washington, with the invaluable assistance of the French fleet, delivered the decisive blow he had been dreaming about for 6 long years. While this version of the Revolutionary War possesses all the seductive charm of a great adventure story with a happy ending, at least for the American side, it is not one that Washington himself would have recognized or endorsed. The problem is not simply that what we might call hindsight history glides smoothly toward preordained conclusions, whereas Washington was traveling a bumpy road toward an uncertain destination. The major problem is the presumption that time was an unalloyed American asset. In fact, to the extent that waging war was about raising money and men, time was on the British side, because the London government had developed during the course of the 18th century the most powerful and efficient machine for waging war in the world, fully capable of projecting and sustaining its power almost indefinitely. When Washington took his army into winter quarters at Valley Forge, on the other hand, the Continental Congress lacked the authority to supply either money or men. Popular support for the war continued to decline, and few of the state governments were prepared to impose taxes on their residents or meet their enlistment quotas. "I am now convinced beyond a doubt," Washington wrote to Henry Lawrence, president of the Continental Congress, "that unless some great and capital change suddenly takes place in that line, this army must inevitably be reduced to one or other of these three things: starve, dissolve, or disperse." The unpalatable and ironic truth was that the institutions that had alienated American colonists from the empire, Parliament's taxing power and a well-equipped standing army, gave the British a significant advantage in a protracted war. How, then, did the improbable become the inevitable? Washington's fullest answer, composed soon after victory was assured, suggested that historians would have a difficult time explaining the triumph.
"If historiographers should be hardy enough
to fill the page of history with the advantages that have been gained with unequal numbers on the part of America in the cause of this contest, and attempt to relate the distressing circumstances under which they have been obtained. It is more than probable that posterity will bestow on their labors the epithet and marks of fiction, for it will not be believed that such a force as Great Britain has employed for 8 years in country could be baffled by numbers infinitely less, composed of men oftentimes half-starved, always in rags, without pay, and experiencing at times every species of distress which human nature is capable of undergoing. More succinctly, Washington also observed that the war was won by a concatenation of causes which had never occurred before in human history, and which, in all probability, at no time or under any circumstance will combine again. In the midst of the bedeviling concatenations, he called attention to one abiding core of perseverance, the officers and soldiers of the Continental Army, whose sacrifices would never be fully understood or appreciated. He did not mention the other abiding presence. Modesty forbade it. The crucial event, where the abiding pattern first emerged, was not Saratoga, but Valley Forge. The heroes were not the mass of ordinary citizens, but rather a pathetically small collection of marginal men, the common soldiers of the Continental Army. The main theme was not romantic, but paradoxical. Namely, the unattractive but irrefutable fact that the War of Independence had only been won by defying many of the values the American Revolution claimed to stand for. And the lesson Washington drew from that experience, learned not from books but from struggling on a day-to-day basis with its implications, was that the meaning of the American Revolution, at least as he understood it, had been transformed during the course of the war into a shape that neither he nor anyone else had foreseen at the start. It was a war not just for independence, but also for nationhood. Blood on the Snow. The most graphic piece of visual evidence about the legendary winter at Valley Forge happens to be true. No less a source than Washington himself described the shoeless soldiers tracking blood on the snow. To see men without clothes to cover their nakedness, without blankets to lay on, without shoes by which their marches might be traced by the blood from their feet, he recalled, is a mark of patience and obedience which, in my opinion, can scarce be paralleled. Most of the horses died from starvation or exposure, and their decaying carcasses filled the air with a stench that joined with the blood in the snow to create sensory scenes that Washington never forgot. When other leading members of the revolutionary generation subsequently spoke or wrote about the importance of virtue during the American Revolution, they invariably described a classical ideal enshrined in political treatises by prominent philosophers like Montesquieu. Washington's understanding of virtue was more palpable and primal, shaped by direct exposure to scenes of mass suffering that, as he put it, will not be credited but by those who have been spectators. Nearly a century later, when Abraham Lincoln referred in his first inaugural to those mystic chords of memory that linked his Civil War generation with those predecessors who had created the American Republic, the haunting imagery suggested a shared political idea. Washington's memory was less mystic, but equally haunting. It was men shedding blood. the men shedding most of the blood at Valley Forge and throughout the remaining years of the war came from the lowest rung of American society. "When men are irritated and the passions inflamed," Washington observed somewhat caustically, "they fly hastily and cheerfully to arms." Those exuberant days of popular enthusiasm for the war were now gone forever, as were the enlistments by yeoman farmers and men of the middling sort who had manned the barricades during the Boston siege. Their places in the ranks of the Continental Army were now filled by indentured servants, former slaves, landless sons, and recent immigrants from Ireland and England. These were the young men, usually between 15 and 25 years of age, who lived in the makeshift log huts at Valley Forge and signed on for the duration of the war, because in most cases they had no brighter prospects. Washington harbored no romantic illusions about these ordinary soldiers, claiming that to expect among such people as comprise the bulk of an army that they are influenced by any other principles than those of interest is to look for what never did and I fear never will happen. He was prepared to string them up if they attempted to desert or fell asleep on sentinel duty and order 100 lashes to their bare backs for minor infractions. For their part, the soldiery, as he called them, routinely defied regulations about hair length and decorated their uniforms with ribbons, feathers, and fur in order to make the very term uniform a standing joke. Despite the distance between them, which Washington regarded as an accurate reflection of the social hierarchy that God intended, and all his experience as a Virginia planter aristocrat confirmed, the general and his troops enjoyed a mutual sense of admiration. The soldiers were known to chant the sing-songy tune War and Washington so endlessly that visiting civilians complained of mental paralysis. And Washington not only saluted their silent suffering at Valley Forge, but also recognized their staying power as the decisive factor in the eventual American victory. Given the potent, if latent, egalitarian convictions of the American Revolution, the camp culture at Valley Forge was richly ironic. A near-perfect embodiment of the Aristotelian hierarchy, the one, the few, and the many. The enlisted men were obviously the many, a faceless multitude of cast-offs that one soldier described on the march as a cavalcade of wild beasts. Washington was obviously the one, the singular figure whose birthday was about to be celebrated as a national holiday like European monarchs, and who was first described in a Pennsylvania almanac for 1778, albeit in German, as the father of his country. That left the officers as the designated few. During the Valley Forge encampment, the officers of the Continental Army began to assume the manners and trappings of a self-conscious American aristocracy. Their claim to elite status was not inherited bloodlines, though a few officers, that is, Lord Stirling, Baron DeKalb, did affect full-fledged European titles. Their presumed superiority was based on their revolutionary credentials as the ultimate repository of commitment to the cause of American independence. They had come to see themselves, and Washington encouraged this perception, as the chosen few who preserved and protected the original ethos of 1775 and 76 after it had died out among the bulk of the American citizenry. They were the band of brothers that sustained the virtuous ideal amidst an increasingly corrupt and disinterested civilian society. Whereas English aristocrats could rest comfortably in their privileged role, it was, after all, a socially sanctioned birthright, the officers at Valley Forge were constantly trying to prove they deserve their elite status. Washington spent countless hours overseeing questions of rank between officers who refused to serve under anyone they considered junior. Officers frequently demanded court-martials to answer hearsay accusations of negligence or cowardice bandied about at the campfires. General officers vied with each other for status by employing multiple servants to handle their horses and baggage. And in this honor-driven world of fragile egos, the ultimate recourse when one's reputation was impugned was the duel. Although dueling was officially illegal in the Continental Army, it became commonplace at Valley Forge. John Lawrence felt the obligation to defend Washington's honor against the libels of Thomas Conway, challenged him, and gained satisfaction by shooting Conway in the mouth. As the soldiers shivered and starved in silence, their officers, who enjoyed more comfortable quarters and warmer clothing, made Valley Forge into a noisy arena for their personal pretensions. And if we think of Valley Forge as a stage, three men destined to have a significant impact on Washington's career made their appearance on it at this time. The first was a young lieutenant attached to Daniel Morgan's elite corps of Virginia sharpshooters named John Marshall. Even though he was recovering from a wound in the hand received at Brandywine, Marshall's athletic prowess in foot races and jumping contests — he could supposedly leap over obstacles 6 feet high — caught the attention of the troops and earned him the nickname Silver Heels. Though there is no record that Washington noticed him, Marshall certainly noticed Washington, and at Valley Forge began his lifelong role as the champion of Washington's legacy in American history. Marshall wrote the definitive Washington biography of his time, and subsequently imposed for all time Washington's version of America's original intentions in his landmark decisions as the nation's preeminent jurist and most influential interpreter of the Constitution. Then there was the Marquis de Lafayette, a 19-year-old French nobleman who was also recovering from a wound suffered at Brandywine. Lafayette came by his title the old-fashioned European way. He inherited it. Initially, Washington looked upon Lafayette as another of those imperious and unqualified French volunteers who kept showing up in camp and demanding to be made a general. But his personal courage in battle — "The Marquis is determined to be in the way of danger," and willingness to serve at any rank — endeared him to Washington, making Lafayette the French exception, and eventually the chief symbol of the gloriously effective Franco-American alliance. More than his military contribution, which proved crucial in the early stages of the Yorktown campaign, Lafayette's importance to Washington was deeply personal. The bond of cordial affection established at Valley Forge grew into a mutual affinity and emotional attachment that made Lafayette, even more than aides like Hamilton and Lawrence, Washington's surrogate son. In the presence of Lafayette, the famous Washington aloofness melted into pools of candor and intimacy, and the letters addressed to "My dear Marquis" are the most expressive, playful, and unprotective in the entire Washington correspondence. Presumably, the letters to Martha were equivalently revealing, all the more reason to decry their destruction. Washington liked to tease Lafayette, for example, with the accusation that his failure to bring his young wife to America was rooted in a silent fear that she would fall in love with an older man, namely Washington himself. Lafayette was the major outlet for Washington's human side, and their letters provide the clearest evidence that he had one. Finally, there was Friedrich Wilhelm August Heinrich Ferdinand, Baron von Steuben. Steuben's title was a complete fabrication, as was his claim of intimacy with Frederick the Great and his rank of general in the Prussian army. But in addition to being a lovable fraud, Steuben possessed a thorough knowledge of Prussian and French military procedures and an infectious enthusiasm for drilling troops on the parade ground. Soon after turning up as an unannounced volunteer at Valley Forge, Steuben was briskly, if rather incoherently, his English was studded with German profanities, shouting marching orders to platoons, then companies, then whole regiments. Steuben's impact on the discipline of the Continental Army only becomes comprehensible when one realizes that prior to his arrival, there had been no uniform standards of march and maneuver at all. And whereas modern-day soldiers complain that daily drilling is a tiresome and mostly useless exercise designed to occupy time, on 18th-century battlefields, the ability to move precisely from column to line formations and vice versa made a crucial difference in delivering maximum firepower at the point of attack or maintaining military order during a strategic retreat. This is not to mention that standing calmly at attention while the man abreast of you is disemboweled by a cannonball is an acquired skill and not a natural act. In May 1778, Steuben became Inspector General of the Continental Army, and soon thereafter his regulations, popularly known as the Blue Book, became the standard source of disciplinary standards for all units. More than anyone else, Steuben was responsible for injecting a professional standard of performance into the Continental Army, blending a European code of obedience to authority onto an American army of inveterate individualists, shaping the raw material huddled in the huts of Valley Forge into the hard instrument Washington needed, but until 1778 had not commanded.